Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Kendall, and I will be your host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally, in Washington, D.C., and in over 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to our website at www.hinckley.utah.edu for more information. The title of today's forum is A Reporter's Perspective of the Utah State Legislature. Today's guest is a columnist for the Salt Lake Tribune. Please join me in welcoming Paul Raleigh.
Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to come back to the Hinckley Institute. I was a student here back in the 70s, and I was a political science major and journalism major, but I never missed the coffee and politics sessions that they had when I was up here. I'm sure you still do, or some variation, and they always had great speakers. I probably learned more from the lectures that I attended in the Hinckley Institute, or just as much as I did from a lot of my classes. So it's where you really learn, the practical aspects of government and politics and how they intermesh. So I always felt that the students of the University of Utah were very lucky and fortunate to have something like the Hinckley Institute of Politics. But anyway, I'll tell you a little bit about myself, and then I'll talk about my perspective a little bit. Your professor always likes to have you ask me a lot of questions, so I want to give you plenty of time for that. But I started at the Tribune in 1973, and all but for 3 years since then, I've been at the Salt Lake Tribune. I've covered just about every beat at the Tribune. I started as a copy boy and worked my way up the traditional ladder, newspaper ladder. Back in those days, you were a copy boy, and then you were an obit writer, and then a night police reporter, and then general assignment, and then you went into usually some kind of a beat after that. I have been a business editor at the Tribune before I started this column. I also, for the most part, was a political and government writer, covered the Utah State Legislature for several years. I spent 3 years at United Press International, the wire service, in the Salt Lake Bureau, and covered the legislature and state government, and was the Utah political correspondent to the UPI's National Political Report while I was at UPI. And then I came back to the Tribune, covered the legislature for a number of years and before I became business editor, and then started the column in 1991 with Joanne Jacobson Wells. We called it Raleigh and Wells. We came from two different perspectives, and that's how the column worked. And then Joanne retired in 2004. And I've been doing the column alone ever since. And I think it's changed a little bit in the tone. I'm more political. My interests are more political and that sort of thing. When Joanne was doing it with me, we did a lot of human interest stuff, and I'm a little bit too much of a curmudgeon for that. She was sort of the bright side of the column. I was kind of the hard-nosed, grouchy guy. There is a big difference in how I still cover the legislature a lot in my column, but there's a big difference in how I do it now than when I was a reporter, because now I'm a columnist. And so you have to look at it from a different perspective, because you have to look at it as a columnist. It's your job to interpret what's going on. And put your perspective on it and your bias, because that's what a columnist does. And then you also have to be, accurate, just as you are when you're a hard news, objective reporter. you have to check your facts. And my column is I would say, is still, I've always been considered myself a reporter more than a columnist. I never really expected to be a columnist. It's just the way it turned out. I was asked to do it. But I've always considered myself a hard news reporter, and so that's reflected, I think, in my column. It's not a pure column, say, like George Will, who is a conservative columnist, or we have our liberal columnists as well, and you can always predict what they're going to say based on their politics. They're always going to be, like a George will be very conservative. Some of the others who are more liberal will, where they're coming from, and they'll come from a liberal perspective. I'm more back and forth, and I'm more of an event-based columnist, where I'll talk about certain events and then put an interpretation to it, as opposed to a ideological columnist who always has the same ideology no matter what he's talking about, whether it be liberal or conservative. In Utah, I do have a brand, and I do have, my opinions are pretty evident in my column. In Utah, the Democratic Party is so small in terms of elected officials and its representation of the legislature. There are only 13 Democrats in the 75 member House, so it's 62-13, and I believe it's down to 13 now. And there are only 5 Democrats in a 29 member Senate, so it's 24-5. So the Democrats have very little say in the legislature, and a lot of that has to do with gerrymandering. The Republicans would have a huge majority even without the gerrymandering, but they have had gerrymandering, which is, I think, is probably makes about a 4 or 5 seat difference in the House and one or two seat difference in the Senate. If the boundaries would have been were more fairly drawn, if I can say fairly, if I have imply that gerrymandering oftentimes is not fair. In fact, I'll get off on gerrymandering for just a second, and that is, I believe that gerrymandering across the country, and your professor is actually an expert on this subject, and I've interviewed him about it before for my column. But I believe that gerrymandering is one of the most destructive things that we have in our country right now as far as getting a responsible, workable government, because, across the country, and both parties do it. I mean, if the states that are controlled by Democrats, they'll gerrymander congressional districts to help the Democrats and get more Democrats elected. The states that are controlled by Republican legislatures and governors will gerrymander the districts to favor Republicans. And the result of that is you get all these safe seats around the country where whatever party did the gerrymandering or redistricting will that it's a safe seat for that party, and the result of that is it'll then trend to the more extreme part of the party, and that's why in the United States Congress today you have such a disconnect, and you can't get anything done because you have these ideological extremes and extremists who are not interested in working across party lines, and then even the more moderate, let's say Republicans now, given the recent shutdown of the government and what happened between Congress and the administration, and the absolute lack, inability to sit down and compromise and have a discussion to get the country moving is many of the Republicans in Congress who would prefer to make a deal and prefer to move something forward, they have been threatened with a Republican primary challenge, from the right, if they don't stick with the plan of forcing Obama to of defunding Obamacare, which was never going to happen and was never going to work. But a lot of Republicans who are more reasonable, really in the way they go about their job, they went along with the extremists because they're more afraid of getting defeated by a more right-wing candidate in their own party than they are of being defeated by a Democrat, because they're already in a safe Republican district. And that's one of the reasons why this impasse went on for so long. And you have the same dynamic in the state legislature, where you have Utah is heavily Republican, but it's not as Republican as is represented in the legislature. Utah's, I would say, something more like 60-40, or maybe 62-38, maybe, Republican over Democrat. So it is heavily Republican. But in the legislature, it's more like 80%, Republican, and those seats often held by the more extreme people in the party rather than so the more moderate Republicans. When I covered the legislature full time back in the 80s and the 90s, you had a lot of what I'd call moderate Republicans who worked with the governor and worked. When Matheson was governor, the Democratic governor, there were Republicans he could count on to. Norm Bangor was one of them. In fact, one of the best relationships. People talk about the relationship between Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan when Tip O'Neill was the Democratic Speaker of the House and Ronald Reagan was the Republican president, and they were able to get things done because they were able to sit down and talk and negotiate, and Tip O'Neill realized that Reagan was the president, so he was going to get, he understood that Reagan should get most of what he wanted, but Tip O'Neill always made sure he got a little piece that would make the Democrats happy, and that's how it worked. And it was the same when Norm Bangor was the Speaker of the House and the state legislature in the state house, and Scott Matheson was the Democratic governor. They worked together very well, and then Bangor, if you know your Utah history, then succeeded Matheson as governor of the state of Utah. And so then you had a lot of compromising and a lot of give and take, even with a Republican-dominated legislature back in those days. But now, because it's become so extreme, and a lot of that, I believe, has to do with gerrymandering. We've had gerrymandering, real blatant gerrymandering now in Utah the last three cycles, redistricting cycles. That redistricting always takes place a year after the census is taken. And so because of that, we've gotten more and more extreme. Now, we had this last time, you had Mike Lee defeated Bob Bennett, as you know, and Bob Bennett was, if you read my column just this last Sunday, I wrote about this, and I wrote about Bennett, and I wrote about what he would be doing if he were still in the Senate. And he was a negotiator. He was a guy who could be counted on in the Senate, a respected conservative Republican who could reach across party lines. And he actually co-sponsored a bill with a health reform, care reform bill, with a Democrat from Oregon by the name of Wyden, Senator Wyden. And they And Bennett was able to put it was a compromise piece of legislation, and Bennett had his conservative Republican market-based principles in the bill, and Wyden had what the Democrats like of more of a universal coverage individual mandate in his bill. That eventually didn't make it through politics and the way politics works back there. And then Obamacare came, and Bennett doesn't like Obamacare, but the way he would deal with it would be to, now that it's the law of the land, let it take place, and then point out, as the loyal opposition, as a Republican, the deficiencies of Obamacare, and use that as a campaign platform in the 2014 elections, rather than just refuse to try and hold the country hostage, which is the difference now between the extremists that you've got in Congress because of gerrymandering, like I said, and because those extremists are backed by very deep pocket organizations, because you have these PACs now that have emerged as a result of the Citizens United case, where the Supreme Court, ruled that these political action committees could raise untold, amounts of money, and they didn't have to show where their donations came from. And so now, as a result, you've got these big pocket PACs like FreedomWorks, Club for Growth, and things like that, that are backed by very rich people who want their agendas and have a lot of money they can put into these PACs, and that's why Republicans are afraid of angering the right-wing base, because they have so much money that they can use against them in a Republican primary. And so that's what you have going on, and that's why you had an impasse. And then in Utah, that's what happened. You had the Tea Party movement at 2010, where Mike Lee came along, and he was a Tea Party darling and very, very right-wing, and they attacked Bennett for being a negotiator. They attacked Bennett because Bennett was one of the people who negotiated TARP, the bailout of the financial institutions, which I believe needed to happen, or we would have gone into a depression. And most of that money has been paid back now. But Bennett was attacked for that. He was attacked because he was more moderate on immigration reform. And then when Obamacare passed, even though that wasn't Bennett, he still had his name on a bipartisan bill, health care bill, with a Democrat, and they attacked him on that. And it was the Tea Party, 2010 was a crazy year, and you had in fact I heard that Bennett was defeated, frankly, that year, the night of the neighborhood caucuses in March. And I had a lot of sources around the state. And the next day after the neighborhood caucuses, where you go and you elect your delegates from your neighborhoods, who then go to the conventions, I called around, and basically the term that was given to me was it was a bloodbath. Against Bennett, people were so rabid against Bob Bennett people who even were afraid to even stand up and say they supported him, or if they were running for delegate, to even say they were uncommitted. You had to get up and say you were against Bob Bennett if you even had a chance to get elected in a lot of these neighborhood caucuses, because the Tea Party was able to get people out and just swarm the neighborhood caucuses. As a result of that, you had a very right-wing legislature as well. Not just a Republican legislature, but more of a Tea Party legislature, more of libertarian types dominating the legislature after 2010. As a result of that Tea Party influx, at the neighborhood caucuses and then at the state conventions. But a very interesting thing happened in 2012. Orrin Hatch saw what happened to Bob Bennett in 2010. And Orrin Hatch, who has a lot of money, who can raise as much money as he ever wants because he's been an incumbent in the Senate for 36 years. He was elected in 76, so 37 years. He realized that the fight was going to be at the neighborhood caucuses that year. So that's where he put much of his resources, and he spent a lot of money canvassing neighborhoods around the state, canvassing the different districts, the voting districts, and identifying his people and making sure that they got to the neighborhood caucuses. At the same time, the LDS Church, I believe, demonstrated that they it was a little worried about the tone, the political tone that came after 2010. And so, you know, every election year, the church sends out a statement that the bishops in all the local wards read from the pulpit that basically encourages people to go out and support the party of their choice and vote and that sort of thing. That in 2012, it was a stronger statement, and it said you should go to your neighborhood caucuses, and you should go there to make sure that that responsible people are elected delegates. There were too many wackos elected delegates in 2010. I mean, that was basically the implication of the statement. And so the neighborhood caucuses swelled in 2012 because Hatch got his people out there, and then a lot of people felt they, wanted to go after the statement that they heard from the church. And the result of that was all of a sudden a more moderate push back in the legislature, because the people who got elected to make sure that Hatch didn't get defeated by a right-wing opponent like Bennett did. Bennett lost in the convention. Had Bennett gotten through the convention, the conventional wisdom is that he would have won the primary and then he would have won the general election. He'd still be senator. But he was defeated at the convention by the delegates. So the result of that was, and then you had Mike Lee and Tim Bridgewater, who had a very ugly Republican primary, and then Lee just barely won the primary, and then of course, once he got the nomination, it was academic because a Republican was going to win. A Republican's always going to win those big offices, statewide offices. Jim Matheson is the one exception to that. Although I think that Jim Matheson's could be in trouble this next election year. The Republican has been trying to knock him off for 12 years, and they might do it this year. They've given him, he's always had a Republican district, but they've made it more with their gerrymandering, made it more and more Republican all the time. So this last legislative session was kind of interesting because a lot of the real right-wing people in the legislature got defeated in the convention because of a more moderate influence that was introduced because of the Hatch efforts, like I've talked about. A lot of the real rabid right-wing guys got defeated, and there was a little, it's still a very conservative Republican legislature. And it all, don't get me wrong, it always will be. But it moderated a bit, and there's more of a tolerance or a discussion now about more funding for education, for public education, and you've still got your elements in the legislature that think Common Core. Does everybody know what Common Core is? No? It's a very controversial thing that's going on. Common Core is basically a set of standards for certain grades in school. They come up with a certain, it's not a curriculum, but it's standards, and so each grade needs to meet these standards. And it was basically put together. It was an idea that came out of the National Governors Association, and then governors appointed people and educational people to all get together, and I can't remember how many states, but it's more than 40 states. It's about 42, 43 states participated in this, and then they came up with these standards, and that now has been and then the states that participated adopted these standards, and that's been turned into this socialistic Obama plot now by the right wing, who think that this is some horrible, socialistic national conspiracy to usurp Utah values in education, and somehow they've got a lot of people to believe that this was actually a federal government plot rather than what it really was, which was a collaboration of the states to come up with, and they wanted to get a uniform standards to make it easier for when kids moved from one state to another, they could go in and expect to have the same type of standards that they needed to meet. And this began with the mathematics and language arts. From state to state, and that was the whole idea of it. But that's a big fight that's still going to go on. There's an element of the legislature that wants to repeal that or get the state school board to get Utah out of it. That'll be a fight. There'll be a fight over funding for public education like there always is. But it is a little more moderate this year than it used to be. You've still got very powerful right-wing organizations like the Eagle Forum that have a lot of influence over the legislature. I'm going to let you start asking questions in a minute, but I'll say one more thing, and that is one thing to watch for in the legislature this year, it'll be very interesting, is how the Speaker of the House, Becky Lockhart, who's the first woman Speaker of the House in Utah, how she interacts and how the legislature interacts, or the House in particular, with Governor Gary Herbert, because Becky Lockhart's going to run for governor in 2016. And what her plan is, is she's going to serve this session, this 2014 session in the legislature as speaker, and then she's not going to run for re-election in 2014. And then she's going to leave the legislature and then spend the next 2 years running. And Gary Herbert has not said whether he's going to run for another term in 2016 yet or not, but he's raising a lot of money. He just had another big gala where he probably raised $1 million So the feeling is, the suspicion is that he would like to run for another term. So there could be a big face-off between Becky Lockhart and Gary Herbert for the Republican nomination. And that's going to play out. I think you're going to see that play out a lot in the session, in the 2014 legislative session, of those two people trying to one-upsmanship each other and take credit. There's an interesting offshoot to that. Becky Lockhart and her supporters spent a lot of money and a lot of effort to get John Dougal, who was a legislator from Utah County, elected state auditor. And he defeated in the Republican primary a longtime auditor, Austin Johnson, Republican, and who'd been there, I can't remember how long, but maybe 20 years or close. But Dougal had the support of the Lockhart faction of the legislature, and they gave him a lot of money, and he defeated Johnson and now is the auditor. And you're starting to see now a lot of critical audits coming out against, you know, in of the different departments, you know, performance audits, again, in the different departments of state government, which I believe will be used eventually to attack or demean the administration of Gary Herbert. And we'll see how that plays out. And with that, I'd like to open up for questions. If you don't have questions, I got a lot more I can talk about. Yes, sir.
You get a microphone here.
I don't need a mic.
For the air here.
Okay, so if you'll first name, last name, and maybe identify your major, and therefore the radio audience will know who you are. Okay, first question.
My name is Brad Groters. I'm a political science and environmental studies major. Thank you for coming today. I appreciate it. It was very insightful. You mentioned that some columnists are more, you know, one side of the aisle or the other, and you kind of said that you were more middle of the road. I was curious, you know, with your middle of the road stance, you know, are you seeing equal access, you know, from both sides of the aisle, or do you feel like you're able to reach out to one side or the other more than the other?
I'm considered in Utah. I mean, my brand is probably that I'm a liberal, that I'm considered more liberal. Although I'm not, I have written a number of columns supporting different, you know, Republicans. I've made it very clear that I thought Bob Bennett was a good senator and a Republican senator. And I have access to all sides. And one thing I have to say is even the politicians that I have criticized, and I have roundly criticized some of them, they'll return my calls, and they'll give me access. I have to admit that I'm treated pretty well by both sides of the aisle. And I mean, I have access to Becky Lockhart. I have access to the governor, usually through his press secretary. But I always get a response. They always return my calls, and they're always very respectful. And even most of the legislators who I've banged on pretty hard are pretty respectful to me when I call them. I think most of them understand that, you know, I've got a job to do, and I call them as I see them, and then it's their job to convince me of, you know, that they're right in what they're doing. I've got great access to you know, to all of them. The Republicans, even though, you know, they see me as a liberal and the liberal media kind of guy and stuff, I get along with them very well. In fact, some of my, you know, one advantage I have as a columnist is I don't necessarily need to name my sources. And that's important, because if people can tell you things without them being named, and we have a rule at the Tribune, and most newspapers do, that in our regular news stories, you know, that your sources have to be named. You know, there has to be attribution to what you're saying. I don't have to do that in my column, and because it's me saying it, you know, as a columnist. And a lot of times I'll say what I do say or express an opinion based on conversations I've had with people who want to tell me, you know, give me the information anonymously, because if they're not anonymous, they're not going to come forward, because then they'll get in trouble. There are all sorts of ways to punish people in government for, you know, talking to the press. And so that's an advantage I have as a columnist. But some of my sources, as I was going to say, are some of the, would surprise you, are some of the highest level people in government. You all will call me up and they'll give me tips.
My name is Scott Drescher. I'm a student here at the University of Utah, political science major. How much time do you spend a day studying others' takes on things? How much time do you spend reading others' articles, either nationally or locally? And how much time do you spend working on, and like how many articles are you working on at any given time?
Well, that's a good question. I probably spend maybe an hour a day seeing what other columnists or other takes, or just, you know, reading the news. As far as how many things I'm working on, I could be working, I could have 20 different issues on the shelf that I, you know, will pick and take from time to time. My Monday, Wednesday, I write basically two different kinds of columns. I've got my Monday, Wednesday, Friday column, which is an items column, usually. And each column will have three or four items, and they could be about anything, really. And sometimes they'll just be funny little quips, or, you know, those are not always politics. They're different things that happen to people. I've got a column item in tomorrow. It's not my main thing. It's my last column item, but it's about these guys at a liquor store in Bountiful were, it was a very busy time in the store, and all of a sudden they kept hearing this horn honking in the parking lot. And then this woman rolled her eyes and said she'll be back and went out, came back a few minutes later, and then the horn started honking again. Turns out that she's got this very impatient dog that she takes with her, and if she's in a store for too long, he'll start honking the horn. And so once in a while, I'll do things like that. That'll be part of my items column, funny little things like that.
Like public interest kind of
stories. Yeah, right. Yeah, and my items can be vary anywhere from in the Monday, Wednesday, Friday column anywhere from 6 or 7 inches to maybe just a paragraph, and then I write a Sunday column in the opinion section, and that's a more in depth column that focuses exclusively on local politics. I don't write about national politics very often, unless it has something to do with one of our Mike Lee has been in the news a lot, with being one of the lead people in this government shutdown fight. And so when that happens, then I will get into national politics. But my Sunday column, for the most part, focuses just on local politics. That's what I know, and I know the history of it and that sort of thing. But because of my Monday, Wednesday, Friday columns are items columns, maybe 3 or 4 or 5 different items in a column, I'm constantly working on different things and different issues, and they might not have anything to do with each other whatsoever. And then I've always, in the same time, figuring out what I want to write for my Sunday column that I have to turn in on Thursday afternoon. So if that answers your question. Yes, sir.
Name is George Fita from Tonga. And my question is, the former governor, Mike Leavitt, yesterday mentioned about George Washington being the most peer influential politician in our history, in U.S. history. And what he meant by that, you couldn't get politicians or delegates together to a convention unless you mentioned that Washington was going to be there. He had that reputation. He was well respected. With your experience covering the Utah State Legislature, is there a person or a politician in that legislature that we need to be aware of that has that type of influence?
Locally, what you're saying. Well, that's a really good question. Over the years, when Norm Bangerter was Speaker of the House, he really commanded a lot of respect. When he became governor, I wouldn't call him one of the. I mean, he was a good governor, but he wasn't one of the greats. Calvin Rampton was a governor. He was a three-term governor from Utah. He was elected in '64 and then served till '72. And he basically he commanded a lot of respect. You might throw Hatch into that mix a little bit simply because he's been around so long. But I wouldn't call him a greatly respected character like George Washington, for example. Mike Leavitt had a lot of detractors when he was governor. In fact, when he ran for a third term, he actually got a primary. He was forced into a primary by a Tea Party type guy, and that was before the Tea. We called it the Tea Party, but it was the same, type of person, candidate. But a lot of people now are kind of missing Mike Leavitt. I do know that I would be surprised if Mike Lee doesn't get a strong challenge in the Republican primary in 2016. There are a lot of Republicans very upset with him, and they feel that he is made it too much of a circus atmosphere, and he's hurt the Republican brand. But as far as any local people, I'll tell you a guy who is really revered here in Utah is John Huntsman Sr. Because of all that he's done, philanthropic efforts that he's done, and that sort of thing, and I think his son was elected governor largely on his name. But a lot of people now are kind of wishing to have John Huntsman Jr. back. You know, you hear a lot of talk like that. I wrote a column on Monday where there's a little bit of a movement to see if there could be a Hillary Clinton John Huntsman Jr. ticket for the presidential ticket in 2016. You know, going across party lines and trying to bring back some kind of bipartisanship to get away from this atmosphere we have now of everybody being so partisan and set on one side or the other. That's the best way I can answer that question. It was a good question, but I can say I don't think we've ever had a George Washington kind of character in Utah politics, that at least that I can remember.
Hi, I'm Katie. I am a health student here at the U. From being a political science student, how did you choose the more writing media route of political science?
Well, I was a double major. I was a political science and journalism major here at the U. I started out here knowing that what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a news reporter, and I wanted to be a political reporter. And I was always interested in politics. And when I was a kid, I was always interested in current events. And I always seemed to be able to, you know, do well on my English papers and my essays and that sort of thing. So I kind of had a natural bent for writing. And so those two things just kind of meshed together. But I probably wanted to be a news reporter from the time I was in junior high school. But I wanted, you know, I tell journalism students today, you know, you can learn, write, you know, you can take journalism classes and you learn how to write and you learn how to edit and you learn how to, and in today's academia and journalism, you're learning social media. That's the future. But I've always said, get a double major, take something else, you know, because you have to have a knowledge of something to write about. And in my case, it was political science, but, you know, or, you know, I always say business or whatever, you know. And so that was my choice, but I always knew I wanted to be a news reporter.
Hi, my name's Nish, and I am a social work major with hopefully a minor in political science and looking to go into public policy. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned earlier that gerrymandering is one of the most destructive things to our government, and I was wondering if you personally would argue that it's unconstitutional and if you foresee it becoming, all types of gerrymandering becoming illegal in the future.
Well, the Constitution is silent on that. I don't know that I could call it unconstitutional. I certainly believe that it's a perversion of what of the Constitution, and it's a perversion of what the Constitution was trying to impart. The writers of the Constitution, the kind of government and the kind of system they had, because it resulting in us being a republic, you know, where our elected officials are actually representing the wishes of the majority, it's become almost an oligarchy or a plutocracy where now the elected officials, you know, because of gerrymandering and because of these big deep pocket PACs, that fund them, they're not worried about what the people, you know, the majority in their districts are thinking or whether they're going to be reelected, you know, by them. They're worried about what, you know, a certain minority who have deep pockets and who have deep, you know, maybe extreme ideologies, what they're thinking, because they're not worried about getting defeated in a general election. They're worried about getting defeated by somebody in their own party. So, you know, I can't say that it's unconstitutional, because I mean the Constitution is silent on that. I mean, you know, and the Constitution does give, you know, the Congress, you know, the ability to, you know, make its own rules and that sort of thing. But I certainly believe it's not what it's resulted in, something that is not different from what the founding fathers had in mind when they wrote the Constitution.
Hi, excuse me. Hi, my name is Jimmy Gamma. I major in political science. My question to you is, I just want to say, like, you seems to be more experienced in the field of journalism, and you covered from the state legislature and to, from the state legislature, and then as well as you also doing your job as a columnist. In the future, do you have any intent to run for political office? As I can look at you, someone experienced, you know about the policies there in the state level, the legislature, the Senate, and in their House of Representatives.
I've got a pat answer to that question. I've been asked that before, because I am a political junkie, and you know, I think about politics a lot, and I like to talk about it a lot, and of course I write about it a lot. So people do ask me that from time to time, and my pat answer is this: I would rather be me than be somebody who has to put up with somebody like me, if that makes any sense. I mean, I have fun covering politics and dissecting it. I don't think I'd want to be the guy on the other end, the guy being dissected by somebody like me. So, no, I've never had an interest in running for public office. I just like to observe it and write about it.
My name is Jefferson Campbell. I'm a student here at the university. My question is, you're talking a lot about Mike Lee and how he might face challenges in his primary election in 2016. My question is, in your experience, this is all stuff that is happening in 2013. He hasn't been being viewed very favorably right now by his constituents at large or by even Republicans. But since he's not up for re-election again until 2016, do you think that this is something that people are going to remember? Or do you think that he might even be replaced by someone who is as far right-wing as him in the primaries? Like, do you think he'd be replaced by another staunch conservative?
You know, I got to compliment you, Tim. Your students are asking very good questions. You know, they really know what they're doing, what they're talking about. That's a very good question, and you're right. This could very easily could blow over in 3 years. I mean, you know, people have short memories, and I'll tell you one thing that has happened with Mike Lee during this whole thing is he's raised a lot of money. He's used this as a fundraising tool. He's been sending out emails, you know, two or three a week during this whole time, you know, and painting himself as this great, you know, savior against Obamacare for us. And he's raised quite a bit of money, and he's going to continue to raise money. And, you know, I don't think he's going to be able to raise a lot of money inside of Utah. I mean, he's never really been that popular of a guy in Utah. He almost got beat in the convention along with Bennett. I mean, Tim Bridgewater came within about 3 or 4 points of eliminating both of them. But Lee has his backers. I mean, he's got the Heritage Foundation. I mean, he is a total, you know, he and the Heritage Foundation, I mean, he and Jim, I mean, he's basically a creature of Jim DeMint, the former senator from South Carolina who's now the head of the Heritage Foundation, and they have a lot of money. Freedom Works has is another one of these PACs that just has untold amounts of money. And, you know, I mean, they're being backed by these billionaires who want these types of policies that favor them. And there's an organization called ALEC. It's called the American Legislative Exchange Council. It's a business-backed organization, but legislators belong to it. And it's very right-wing. And you've heard of has everybody heard of the Koch brothers? You know, everybody knows the Koch brothers, right? The billionaires who basically buy elections. They're a big influence behind ALEC, the organization I just mentioned, and they go the legislators from around the country, and there are many Utah legislators who belong to this, and they'll go to these meetings, and then they'll go to these different workshops and everything else. And then they come back with legislation, and it's always very right-wing legislation, very, very, you know, and you see it all from all the different states, the same kind of legislation. And it's legislation to, you know, suppress voting rights, for example. I mean, it's always legislation that's going to benefit, you know, a certain group or a certain ideology. But you see, and they're big in education. They're big in the education area. They're big on vouchers, you know, the ALEC people, you know, they'll come back and they'll be, you know, in favor of legislation that makes changes to public education and always makes changes toward favorability, toward, you know, helping kids go to private schools or charter schools that are different from your traditional public schools or homeschooling, things like that. And so... I've kind of got off the topic, but the point is, those types of people are going to give a lot of money to Mike Lee, and so because he's their darling, and so he's going to have a lot of money, and because of that, that might scare people off, and I think he's going to get a challenge. People are talking about it. Mitt Romney's son, Josh Romney, has talked a lot about it, running against Mike Lee. Dan Lillenquist, I wrote about that, he's a really smart guy. And Thomas Wright, the former state Republican chairman, is talking about running against Mike Lee. But, you know, you're right. 3 years is a long time, and by the time 2016 comes along, who knows what will have happened. I mean, maybe Obamacare will be a disaster and Mike Lee will be seen as a hero. Right now I'm saying, I think he's going to get a challenge, but 3 years is a long time, and who knows in 2016.
This concludes the radio portion of our program. Let's express appreciation to our guest today.